Hi, I'm Adrienne Hill, and this is your Marketplace Money Podcast for the weekend of May 31st, 2013. Housing is back in the headlines this week, and as you know from the show, the housing market's pretty much been on fire the last 6 months. Almost all the news this week has been positive, too. New home sales up, existing home sales up, pending home sales up, mortgage rates up. Oh, wait. That last one is not so good. People hoping to buy a new home are going to have to pay more in interest now than they would have any time in the last year. And there's a question as to whether or not that pretty much overnight rate jump is going to scare people off from buying. We've got Elise Glink here with some answers. She's a personal finance journalist and syndicated columnist writing about all things real estate. Hi, Elise.
Hey, hi, Adrienne.
So what's going on with interest rates? Why are they up?
Well, they're up because, well, they're down, right? Let's have a little historical
over time,
perspective.
Yes.
My first house when I bought it, I paid 11.75% interest rate.
Wow.
So that now makes me sound really old and really out of touch. But I will say that it's up a little bit because people are trying to decide in the bond market what the Fed is going to do. And right now, the Federal Reserve Bank has been buying to the tune of about $85 billion a month. All kinds of mortgage-backed securities, and that has been depressing the rate that you pay for your interest, and everybody else is paying as well. So banks are paying less, businesses are paying less, and home buyers are paying less.
And so what's the concern? Why are these numbers going up?
They're going up because there's some talk that the Fed might be ending, I think we're at QE3, mm-hmm. right? Quantitative easing number three. And they may be ending it soon. And everybody knows that when the Fed stops depressing these prices, that we are going to see interest rates go up. The question is, do they go up to where they were in 1993, which was 6.5%,
mm-hmm.
or do they go back up to where they were for the last 5 years, which was about under 5%?
Now, we've heard from some listeners that the jump is causing them pause. And Ben from Minneapolis is one of them. Hi, Ben.
Hey.
So tell us a little bit about where you are in your home buying process.
Well, we have a current very small house, and we've signed a purchase agreement for a brand new home that we, you know, did all the paperwork for, got a good faith estimate and all that. A good faith estimate was at 3.875%, which seemed high at the time that we got it, probably 3 months ago. And as of May 1st, I had asked about a long-term lock. We actually close in October, and I'd asked about a long-term lock, 3.6% or something around there. I checked yesterday, and it was at 4.25%, and that's a big difference in your calculus, both on a monthly payment and over the life of a loan. So that's where kind of we were at.
And so what's your plan? I mean, what are you going to do?
I guess I have to write it out. I have to find out when our official closing date is, which if you're buying a new home, you know, there's a couple different steps in there. But once that number just determine, is this rate something that I'm comfortable with right now, and should I execute a long-term lock? But as you know, there's cost to that, and those seem very small compared to the rates over the long term. But that's, I guess, I'm trying to figure out what to do and looking for help.
What do you think, Elise?
So there are some signposts that you know the lay expert can look at, and you too, Ben, to think about where mortgage interest rates are going. I would say overall, I wouldn't pay for a long-term lock. And I also wouldn't think about that mortgage interest rates are going to skyrocket. I've actually heard that word used now relating to what's happened the last 3 weeks anytime soon. In fact, if you think about a signpost, the Fed has said over and over again that they're not going to stop the QE3 quantitative easing buying until we see the jobless rate, the unemployment rate, fall below 6.5%. Right now it's about 7.5%. And it's higher in a lot of other areas. So they're going to keep putting pressure to keep interest rates super low. It is going to ignite the economy at some point in time. But for mortgage interest rates, what you're experiencing is sort of this bumpy bottom where they're going to bump up based on local news. And the minute that it seems like the economy's not doing well, they're going to fall down again. And you're still so far out from buying that house, from closing on it, I think you could give it another couple of months. And when you see one of these dips, that's when you lock in.
What sort of time frame do you think we're talking about, Elise, as far as these rates actually going up some appreciable amount?
Well, we're talking the last 3 weeks is where we've seen them rise up from the ultra low historic all-time low bottom, right? I can't stress that enough. And now they're up about 0.5%. in another 6 months, I actually don't think we're going to see them up any higher. If we have a huge hurricane season and, you know, the Southeast gets hammered again, then we might see that economy look a little bit better. So home building might look a little stronger. So we might see them go up a little bit. But the first sign of bad news, we're going to see them go down. It's very tenuous what's going on out there. And there's a lot of external forces going on around the world. China's down with it, you know, where its growth rate is down. We see Europe it's in a 7-quarter recession. It's like the longest recession they've had since World War II. And things aren't looking so great down in Latin America. So there's a lot of pressure. U.S. just happens to be like the best of the economies at the moment. And I say that with a little bit of a laugh.
Right.
But it's true. And so, Ben, if you're looking for signposts, what goes on around the world dramatically affects what happens here in the bond market in New York and what will affect going on in your pocket. But if a half a point is going to make a big difference, what you have to think about and everybody else who's listening to us is, have I bought too much house for what I can afford? Because that's really the essential question. A half a percentage point shouldn't be a make or break moment for you.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks so much for joining us, Ben. I'm here with Elise Glink, author of the syndicated column Real Estate Matters, and we're chatting about buying a house. We've been talking about this all week over on our Facebook page. And one thing that came up this week was the way the path to homeownership has actually changed over time. And I wonder what you think about that, Elise. If you bought a house 10 years ago and one today, what would be different? How has it changed?
Well, I think it's been it's much harder to buy a house today than it was 10 years ago. And I'm not being nuts when I say that basically if you had a pulse and a good credit score, you could qualify for 10 times your income.
10 years ago.
10 years ago. Yeah. That's where we were back in 2003 and 2004. Ah, the good old days.
Yes.
Today, you actually need to have a pulse and a credit score, and you have to have, you know, work, and they have to look at your tax returns. And there are a lot of hoops that you have to jump through that do make it harder for people who are on the edge to qualify. The vast majority of Americans are going to be fine, but credit score is important and your work history is important. And if you're self-employed, it actually is going to be tougher to qualify. There's a box that lenders have created, and if you fit inside the box, you can seriously get qualified in a couple of minutes on the phone. But if you don't fit into the box, if you've made an investment in a neighbor's business and it looks like there might be a $100 loss, huge red flags are going to go up and you might not get your loan.
So we've got Robert from Tustin, California on the line with us. Hi, Robert.
Hi, how are you?
Good. I understand you just closed on a condo. Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
Tell us a little about it. What'd you buy?
I bought a 2-bedroom, 2-bath condominium in Tustin, California. It's a nice place. It's built in 1967, very good condition, and I was fortunately able to get it while interest rates are still relatively low.
So what was the process of buying like for you? How did it go?
For me, since this is my first home, the process was, on my part, I did purchase this with my mother, but for myself, I fortunately, all of my documentation, all of my work history, rental history has all been stored online. So for me, pulling these records and submitting the information that was requested was pretty quick. But when my mom was brought into the process, it became very stressful because, as you said, it was so easy to get a loan back 10 years ago, but now every single little thing about your life has to have a record. They have to have explanation. And for me, while I don't have anything to compare it to, it seemed a little bit more difficult than it used to be.
So, Robert, your mom came on as a co-signer, just to be really clear. But, Elise, I wonder, how common are these documentation issues?
Oh, I think that's very typical. And I love that you have everything digitized. And we tell people now that what you really do want to do is scan all of your records into the computer because you could be asked for them 3 and 4 times, and it wouldn't be unusual. I mean, it might be bad customer service on the bank's end, but for you, you should just go in expecting that this is a headache. But having it digitized and being able to email those papers, that's important. Your mom, this would be a lot harder for her. First, because she's probably not used to scanning and digitizing content. And then email, I know if it's like my mother, email is, you know, a little haphazard sometimes. But really, the process of making of proving to somebody your credit worthiness, and that's the difference. It used to be assumed, and today it's not. And proving every single little thing can be very exhausting for people, even if they're not in their 60s or 70s. It's just an exhausting process. It's mentally taxing.
Robert, your mom also owns a condo, as I understand it, that she bought back in 2001. How different was your process than hers?
A little bit. I do know that even though these both places were the same size, same bedrooms, same square footage, different areas, but I do know back in, she got her condo back in 2001, 2000, and the interest rate on mine is relatively, it's almost half of what she paid. Now, while I think compared to some other people who have 800 credit scores, I locked in at about 3.875. Some people have gotten closer to 3 or maybe under 3 6 months ago. I really can't complain at all because she had a 6.75 interest rate over 10 years ago. So I do know that with her, it was funny because of this process, it's been a little bit more stressful now with all the letters of explanation required, everything that has to be scanned, in addition to the, you know, hundreds of pages of paperwork we did have to sign. She actually went off on one of our lenders. She was so stressful, saying, it never used to be this way. I can't believe I have to do all this stuff. And she sort of took it out on them, and I was just apologizing. Like, she's such a nice lady. I love her. She's a sweetheart. She didn't mean this, but, you know, forgive her because this is all new.
You know, It's funny, Robert. This is a great opportunity, actually, for you to open up a conversation with your mom since you've seen her have this little mental breakdown, but to have a conversation with her about her finances in a larger way and to help get her digitized and ready as she moves into or further into her retirement if she's already there. Because, this generation isn't all online, doesn't feel as comfortable sharing personal information, and yet for you and your the other heirs or siblings, if you have any, you're going to really want to help her as she ages. And this is such a great opportunity to go in and get her ready for the next part of her life.
Yeah, thank you.
Robert, thank you so much for your call. And Elise, thanks for your time.
Thank you both.
It's been a pleasure.
Personal finance journalist Elise Glink is the author of the book, 100 Questions Every First-Time Homebuyer Should Ask. Elise, thanks again.
Thank you very much.
If you're considering buying, we've got a list of programs that can help you think through it. It's on our website, marketplacemoney.org. And if you've got questions, you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. I'm at Adrian Hill with one N. We're also there at Radio Piggy Bank. There are two places most of us spend our time, at home and at work. Now, we're done talking about homes for this week, and we're going to spend the rest of the show talking about the office, which can be filled, at least in my experience, with all sorts of craziness and crazy people. I'm not going to name any names. Our conversation about this topic started online. We had people write into Facebook and on Twitter, and we got a bunch of emails from people looking for advice about how to deal with their workplace dilemmas, their bosses, their colleagues. Well, help is at hand in the form of Ben Dattner. He's an organizational psychologist and the author of The Blame Game. Hi, Ben.
Good to be with you.
So I want to start right in here. What are the common mistakes that we all make when we're trying to get ahead at work? And how do we actually derail ourselves?
Well, I'm an adjunct coach at the Center for Creative Leadership, which means I coach executives about how to maximize their success in their careers, how to have positive impact on the organizations they work in and they lead. And what the Center for Creative Leadership has found over decades of longitudinal research is that people who don't focus on workplace relationships, on organizational politics, and on team dynamics are people who are likely to derail no matter how smart they are technically, financially, or operationally.
So I've got to get along. To get ahead, I've got to get along with people.
That's correct.
All right. I want to go straight to our callers here. And we have Jennifer from Baltimore, who has a story, as I understand it, about a former boss. Hi, Jennifer.
Hi.
So tell us your story about your former boss.
In a previous career, I had a boss who would call me into her office and privately tell me that she saw a lot of herself in me from 10 years before, that she really thought the world of me, all these wonderful things. And then anytime there was a meeting or any sort of public gathering where I had to present something, she would, in some way, shape, or form, dismiss me, humiliate me, or scold me.
Ugh.
So it was rather confusing.
Really confusing.
Yeah.
What do you do, Ben, if you've got a boss who's hot sometimes and cold others?
Well, the first thing to do is to try to answer the question, why? Why is she doing this? Why is she shaming me, undercutting me, and humiliating me? So that can be a tough question to answer. I think people often make the mistake of too quickly going to the boss's personality and try to understand what is it about the boss's personality that is causing her to do this.
Right.
And it may well be the boss's personality. She might be on the spectrum of some kind of personality disorder or difficulty. But before you diagnose that, it's important to try to figure out what is it also about the situation that might be encouraging her to act that way.
And what did you think? Do you have a sense of why she was doing it?
Well, the closest I could come is that I was kind of relatively new in this field, but I was kind of really doing quite well, and I thought I might be threatening her in some way, shape, or form. She was new in her position as well. But it was certainly uncomfortable, regardless of why, and I didn't quite know how to respond to kind of move beyond it, and I ended up leaving the field,
mm-hmm.
leaving the job and leaving the field.
Mm-hmm.
When is that the right thing to do, just to say it's not working?
Well, what I say in my book, The Blame Game, I talk about this, which is that it's not always possible to make a workplace situation better, but it's always possible to make it worse. So if you act, if you overreact, if you're too emotional, if you respond too quickly, you can sometimes make things worse. Now, in the situation that our caller is describing, it may not be possible to make it better. There may be political reasons why your boss is doing this. There may be psychological reasons why your boss is doing this. And even if you confront her, it may be the case that she's not going to stop doing this. However, I think people sometimes prematurely make that judgment, and quitting can be a permanent solution to a temporary problem.
Now, Jennifer, did you ever say to your boss, what's going on?
There were a few occasions where I said, well, you know, we had talked about this issue before we had this meeting, and I brought it up at this meeting, and you seemed so supportive privately, and publicly it did not go well. She said, well, you know, it was just, you know, the organization's not quite ready for it yet, and, well, I could not figure out why, and she never really kind of made anything really clear to me about what was really behind it.
Mm-hmm.
So I, in my confusion, just said, forget it. I'm going to law school.
Well, thank you so much for calling, Jennifer.
Thank you.
So we've got another call. We actually have a couple of questions here about generational differences at work, where you've got a younger boss or you've got older colleagues, older coworkers, sort of the ways that different generations interact with each other. And the first caller we've got is William from North Olmsted, Ohio. Hi, William.
Hello.
So what's going on? Tell me about your work.
Well, right now I'm a paramedic here in Cleveland area. And quite often prior to this, I just became paramedic 4 months ago. Prior to that, I would regularly be paired up with another paramedic I would be a basic. And my paramedic partner would be 21, 22. And I'm pushing 45.
Okay, so significantly younger.
Significantly younger, yes. It was a lot like being in the military again, where you're, you know, much older, and the person who's in charge of you is fresh out of college.
So does that make you a paramedics?
sometimes there's two of us. But yes.
So what's your question for Ben, William?
Well, it's just generally, it's how do you, what's the best strategy for dealing with people who are younger than you, don't have the experience that you do, but are in charge of you? When do you tell them, hey, you know, that's a great idea, but we did that back in 99.
And it didn't work then.
Yeah. Or here's what's wrong with why it didn't work then.
Well, one organization that I think has had to deal with this issue in particular is the military, because you have young lieutenants coming out of West Point and they're leading military teams that have sergeants or corporals who have many, many years in the military, 20, 25 years of experience, and they have combat experience, et cetera. And I think what you need to do, first of all, being mindful that it is a challenge, I think, is the first step. I think if you're not understanding that provides a constraint to your leadership, if you don't know it, there's no way you're going to be able to handle it. But I think trying to explicitly convey respect, I respect your experience, I respect your perspective, I'm not going to pull rank on you. However, I do have the position of authority here, and so I need you in turn to respect that. I think in my experience doing executive coaching, one mistake people often make who are younger who have older people working for them is they tell and they don't show. Mm-hmm. So they tell people, here's my authority, here's my expertise, here's my plan. And they may be protesting too much, working too hard to prove their knowledge rather than focusing on getting the task done.
Now, if you're an older – if you're in a situation where you're the older person and the person who's calling the shots is younger, how do you convey, hey, I do have some institutional knowledge that might be useful in a way that they don't feel like you're trying to step on – you don't step on their toes?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think directly and indirectly conveying respect for their rank – and prefacing anything you say, which is, you know, I thought it might be helpful for me to share my perspective or my experience, and err on the side of being very clear that you're not trying to undercut them, you're not trying to criticize them, you're not concerned about their capabilities or their abilities, but you're simply trying to lend a perspective.
And William, have you had that come up for you? Have there been moments where you've tried that?
Many times. I was a first sergeant in the Army for a while, so I got to deal with that 24-year-old, 26-year-old captain, you know, and tell him, no, ma'am, it doesn't work that way, but had to do it in a polite way. And a lot of times it was doing exactly as he described.
Well, one question that academic researchers have been grappling with is there's sort of a debate about do generational differences really make a difference or not? Is it that you're dealing with millennials now and the young colleague that you described would be presumably born after 1985, so a member of the millennial generation? So does your colleague have particular attributes that are specific to being a millennial, or is it the kind of attributes that anyone at that age, whether they were a Generation X, Generation Y, Baby Boomer, Greatest Generation, that's something that's intrinsic to 20-year-olds rather than something that's intrinsic to millennials?
And what does the research tell us? Where are researchers on this right now?
Well, it's hard to say because, first of all, it's a new area because people have only been millennials for only a few years, so it's hard to establish any kind of longitudinal data. But I think the consensus is that there are some aspects that are specific to this generation having to do with technology, having to do with tweeting, blogging, social media, mm-hmm. Being linked into screens all the time, that difference in the way that people live, work, and communicate has led to some differences in the way people act and react in general and in the workplace in particular. But there's also some evidence that there's just something about being a 20-year-old that makes you act and react in certain ways as well.
Today, we're talking workplace dynamics, and we've got workplace psychologist Ben Dattner with us answering listener questions. Ben, we have another caller here. We have Julian from New York. Hi, Julian.
Hello.
How's New York this time of year?
Very rainy, but it's a good day to be working.
But spring has sprung?
It has sprung, thankfully.
So you've got a question for Ben. What's going on?
Yes, Ben, I really appreciate some help. I lead a human resources team. We've got about 15 people, and initially the team had gotten along quite well, but recently we've been under a lot of pressure for deliverables and running some major processes for our clients around pay planning and the like, and there have been some errors and some slippages in terms of things committed to clients, and the atmosphere in the team has really devolved into a lot of conflict, a lot of finger-pointing. Individual team members come to me to complain about each other. I encourage them to go talk with each other, not about each other. I tried to address it in a team meeting, but there was really not much energy and a lot of silence around trying to address things. It doesn't seem to be working, and the level of teamwork has really disintegrated, and it's not really fun to come to work right now for some of the team members, and it just consumes a lot of my time trying to coach people and have these therapeutic conversations with them. I'm hoping you might be able to give me some guidance on some new things I could try.
Great. Well, are roles and responsibilities clearly specified? Because sometimes what happens is that people look at personality conflicts and think, okay, these personality conflicts are the cause of the difficulty our team is having in communicating and collaborating. But sometimes those personality, on the surface, personality conflicts are really an effect of misaligned incentives or processes, structures, or incentives on the team.
I guess generally the roles and responsibilities are fairly clear in terms of who does what, but maybe with regard to some of the things we've been asked to implement recently, maybe that is a potential issue that we need to at least clarify, you know, who gets to make what decision and who's accountable to who.
So has anything worked? Has anything started to work? Any sort of hints that things might turn around?
Not as yet. You know, I think there are people who take individual initiative and do heroic things and work very hard to fix problems and stay late into the night. But it's not necessarily because of good process or because we're working well together collectively.
Do you hold the team collectively accountable for results?
I guess there are some things I could possibly do in terms of communicating that I am holding them collectively accountable for results. I guess I assume that's implicit, and there may be some things I could do to communicate that more explicitly and give them the sense we're all in this together, mm-hmm. and we rise or fall together.
What I find can be helpful is when you let individuals and the teams know, here's what constitutes doing your work, and here's what constitutes doing it well. Here's the what of what you're individually and collectively accountable for, and also we're going to be paying attention to the how. So it sounds like you guys are having challenges with the how as well as the what.
You know, it's funny. We sometimes give our clients better service than we give ourselves. You know, we give them the best of us. And, you know, we do some of that work with our clients when we are setting goals with them and helping them with their performance management process. We get them focused on not only what are the goals, but what are the key behaviors that they need to demonstrate in order to achieve those goals. And that really helps kind of define the culture for goal accomplishment. We haven't done that for ourselves, especially around these recent processes that we've been having some struggles implementing.
Well, I have a blog for Psychology Today, and I wrote a blog post a while back called The Cobbler's Children Syndrome. And it's actually quite common that people and teams have the toughest time doing for themselves what they're most adept and talented and charged at doing for the people they service or serve.
So at a big level, Ben, what do you think when you're in a workplace that's just not healthy, where people are pointing fingers, they're grumpy, they hate being there? What's the first thing to do? How do you start to change some that?
Well, as a colleague of mine likes to say, treatment without diagnosis is malpractice. So the first thing that you like to do, need to do, is to try to figure out what are the underlying causes? What are the causes? What are the effects of the difficulties that we're having? And what variables can we tweak in order to try to make things better?
Julian, thank you so much for your call.
Thank you. Thank you, Ben, for the help.
Thanks.
So I want to go to another caller, Jay in Raleigh. Are you with us now?
Yes, I am. How y'all doing?
Good. Thanks so much for calling, Jay. So tell me a little, what do you do for a living?
I'm a support engineer for one of the world's largest communications equipment manufacturers.
And what's your question for Ben?
So the current trend in offices is to go to a more open floor plan, you know, less offices with four walls and a door. And so, you know, in cubicle land, you have certain, I guess, etiquette that should be followed. For example, you know, in open spaces, you have the problem of noise. Some people have voices that carry, not really their fault, but, you know, you have people with bad habits. They like to take phone calls on speakerphone wide with it turned all the way up or, you know, yell across the cubes. I guess what's a good way within an organization to sort of encourage better etiquette in these more common open spaces without, you know, making people feel singled out.
Mm-hmm. Now, I have to say, this is a little personal to me. I actually had somebody tape a note on my phone once that said, quiet down. Maybe that's not the best way to deal with it, Ben. What do you think?
That is some pretty direct and candid
yes.
feedback.
And I did quiet down, so it did work. But what do you think? How do you deal with a loud talker?
Okay, well, as a general rule, I think individuals, teams, and organizations should have built-in self-reflection, process checks, and mechanisms for feedback. So I think it's tough when you have to go up to a coworker and say, look, can you please be quiet? I think it's much easier to say, we're going to an open office plan. Why don't we have regular check-ins where we all come together and talk about how it's going? So rather than singling out your coworker and making him or her feel defensive, you can just say in a very gentle way, it's been great that we all have easier access to one another and can see each other at all times. On the other hand, sometimes there's a bit of noise and it's a bit distracting. So if you can say that in a kind of gentle, indirect way about the entire organization or the entire office, that could be less confrontational than singling someone out.
But what if your boss doesn't call that meeting? I mean, what if you never have an opportunity to have that conversation? What do you do?
You can gently suggest to the boss, hey, you know, physical space is very important when it comes to interactions in the workplace. Maybe we need to reconvene and just think, how is this going? There are obviously pros and cons. And without arguing that we need to revisit it, because for cost reasons and logistical reasons and architectural reasons, it might not be possible to revisit it. But why don't we have check-ins and see how is it actually going? Whether there's any major change, if we go to a hoteling system of offices, if we change the nature of our authority, our roles, our interactions, it's always good to build in process checks.
What do you think, Jay? Do you think they'd be open to that kind of meeting at your workplace?
I would think so, yeah, absolutely.
Are you going to go ask for it?
Yeah, I'll go ask
about
it. Or
scream for it? You could just yell.
Alternatively, you can just give us the initials of the offenders in your office and send them the link to this segment.
You could do that.
Maybe also a little more passive-aggressive than you want to be. Jay, thank you so much for your phone call.
Thank you for having me.
All right, Ben, we've got a few more questions coming up, but we're going to take a quick break. On today's show, we're talking about the workplace, how to survive, how to thrive at work. We've got all sorts of callers, we've got lots of Facebook questions, and we've got Ben Dattner here to help us answer all of them. He's an organizational psychologist and workplace consultant. Hi, Ben.
Always a pleasure.
So, Ben, the next question I have for you actually comes from our Facebook account from a listener named Angela. And she writes, after being laid off, I had to take a low-paying job as an assistant that I'm overqualified for. I'm not sure people will believe in me when I try to move up. So you've taken a job. Lots of people have done this in this economy, a job that's well under their skill set. How do you get ahead? How do you get somebody to take you seriously, sort of maybe at the job you're actually meant to be in?
Well, what I always advise my coaching clients to do is to focus on their ings, as I call them.
Their ings.
Their ings, their gerunds, which is what are the ings where you're most passionate, engaged, and successful in what you're doing? Do you like reading, writing, presenting, arguing, advocating, healing, etc.? Finding your ings is more important than the particular role that you're in at any given moment. So people's success in their careers is powered by their ings. So you can be at a high-level job with the wrong ings or a low-level job with the right ings.
So if I really like talking, I should find a job somewhere talking, even if it's a low-level job talking.
That's right, because you're likely to be more engaged, more passionate, more motivated, and more successful if you're in your zone of flow.
Now, how do you advise somebody like Angela? Let's say she is in a job that meets her. It's actually meeting that ing for her, whatever it is. But she's at a very low level, and she just doesn't think her colleagues are going to take her seriously when she applies for the job the next level up, even if she does have those qualifications.
Well, successful individuals work in the situation that they're in. They work hard. They're focused. They add value. They build strong relationships. And as a result, when the need arises within the organization, there can be opportunities to move up. So it's like starting with a blank slate. Rather than focusing on, I used to be at one level and now I'm at a lower level, mm-hmm. think about it instead. This is the cards I'm dealing right now. I've been dealt right now. This is what I'm dealing with. How can I make the best out of this?
So you don't just come up and say, hey, look at my resume. I'm actually really qualified for this job. No?
Well, as we were discussing earlier, showing is always a better strategy than telling.
Huh.
Showing people your capability rather than telling them, I used to be a star, I used to be a contender.
Right.
Nobody's going to care. It's more about showing what you can do in the moment in the particular role that you're in. And it's important also to manage your own emotions, to not feel defensive or embarrassed about the situation that you're in. Any situation has opportunities and any situation has challenges. Every hand's a winner, every hand's a loser.
Angela, thanks so much for writing into our Facebook page. Ben, we've got one more caller, Kathleen from Pennsylvania. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
So tell us a little about your situation. Where are you working? What kind of job do you have right now?
I'm a PhD student, and I work in a research lab. And we have a very diverse set of people who work in this particular lab. We have some students who are older, and I would say mid to late 30s, some even early 40s, or we have very, very younger students who are in their early 20s and don't necessarily have professional experience. So what we find out is, even though it's a research lab, we still have a business setting. We still have to, you know, present to various stakeholders. And our issue that we run into constantly is that the younger students really don't understand the tribal rituals of business. You know, what is etiquette? What are the formalities of, you know, handshaking, how to conduct yourself during a business meeting, sometimes even how to speak. And then we have an additional factor to that is that we have a very culturally diverse population as well. So we also have foreign students. And sometimes, let's just say that the clothing isn't always professional. And it's, how do you know how to approach someone on not only just an etiquette level, but maybe a professional clothing level when you have this cultural diversity, because you don't want to offend anybody culturally?
When you say inappropriate, can you help me understand what you're talking about?
We will have younger students who really come in, particularly sometimes female, who are dressing almost like young teenagers, very, very young teenagers, and it can be very provocative.
And just to be clear, you're not the boss, is that right? You're just a colleague.
Exactly. But, you know, it reflects on all of us, is that in that kind of environment, it does reflect on all of us because we all have to be involved and we're all kind of the same stature. So when something goes bad, you know, it is a reflection of the entire group.
How do you handle that? So you're in a big workplace environment, Ben. You maybe don't have the institutional support. Can Kathleen make some helpful suggestions?
Well, she could suggest that there be a workshop, or she could find some materials or some videos on the internet about common mistakes that people make in terms of attire, grooming, style, and interviews, and try to share those best practices. Looking at the programmatic level, what is our success rate? What kind of feedback do we get, whether it's formal or informal?
So in general, should I not, if I have a colleague who's doing something that maybe I'm uncomfortable with or I don't feel like reflects well on the organization, should I not approach that person directly?
Always better to try to approach them indirectly in
right.
a way that, particularly if people are from different cultures, doesn't cause them to lose face, to be humiliated and embarrassed. So the more you can say, hey, we all stand to improve on this particular dimension, rather than I'm singling out you, one particular colleague, for some candid feedback.
Kathleen, thanks so much for giving us a call.
Thank you.
Ben, we just have a minute here, but before I let you go, I want to ask you one question that's probably on the minds of a lot of people, or at least on our minds for the last 4 years, which is, how do you make sure you're not the first person that gets cut at the end of the day?
I think it's important to realize that we have multiple jobs and to not just think that your job, being successful in your job, is doing the tasks you've been assigned successfully. It's also about making your boss look good to other people, making your colleagues look good, making your boss feel good, making your colleagues feel good. So it's not just about the what, it's also about the how. As Maya Angelou says, people forget what you said, they forget what you did, but what they never forget is how you made them feel. So we all have to realize that there is a socio-emotional component to our careers and our workplace success.
So be nice. Bottom line, be nice.
Do not do unto others what would be hateful to be done unto you.
Ben Dattner is an organizational psychologist and author of The Blame Game, How the Hidden Rules of Credit and Blame Determine Our Success or Failure. Thanks so much, Ben.
Thank you.
Now, we often think of the guy who gets ahead at work as being the sort of person who's super uber confident, the guy who's happy to sing his own praises. But it turns out that's not always right. Adam Grant is professor at the Wharton School and author of the new book, Give and Take. Hi, Adam.
Hello. How are you?
I'm good. So when we think about people in charge, we think of them as the people who sort of muscled or talked their way into the top. But you find that's not always the case.
Yeah, not always the case. So, you know, you could think about a spectrum that has on one end the takers, who are always trying to get as much as they can from other people.
Okay.
On the other end, we have the givers, who actually enjoy helping others and frequently do it with no strings attached. And if you look at a range of professions, from medicine to engineering to sales, the givers are frequently in last, but they're also frequently in first.
So the givers are at both ends of the success spectrum.
That's right. Yeah, there's this amazing group of helpful and generous people who manage to succeed in ways that also lift other people up instead of cutting them down.
So I talked about being nice in the last interview, but being a successful giver actually doesn't mean being nice, right?
Yeah, I think that's one of the common misconceptions, that if you're a helpful and generous person that you have to be a doormat and you
right.
have to be incredibly polite and warm and welcoming. And I find that there's this whole category of people that I call disagreeable givers. Who, you know, might be really gruff and tough on the outside, but at the end of the day, they have your best interests at heart.
So what makes for a successful giver?
Well, I think one of the things that we see among successful givers is they're thoughtful about who they give to. So it's dangerous to give sort of unconditionally to takers who will sort of exploit you frequently.
Okay.
It becomes, you know, much more productive to invest your time in helping givers who are most likely to pay it forward. And then there's this third group of people. Most of us are not pure givers or takers. Mm-hmm. I find most of us are matchers. So a matcher is somebody who looks for an even balance of give and take, quid pro quo. And givers who help matchers find that matchers are the ones who are really looking to reciprocate and pay it back. And so if you spend a lot of your time as a giver helping fellow givers and matchers, it's much more likely to bring benefits as opposed to costs.
Now, if you're one of these givers, though, it's got to take a lot of time. I mean, if I'm out there trying to help everyone every time they need some help, my workday is going to get a little longer.
Well, it can if you're not strategic about it. You know, I think that a lot of people try to become Mother Teresa or Gandhi, and it's just an impossible and exhausting standard. One of my favorite characters in Give and Take is Adam Rifkin, who is named Fortune's Best Networker.
Mm-hmm.
He's an incredible example of a successful giver, and one of his recommendations is that we should all do a few more five-minute favors.
What's that mean?
Well, so a five-minute favor is basically going out of your way to try to help somebody else in some form that's high value to them, but low cost to you. So you might, for example, introduce two people who could benefit from knowing each other, or write a letter to somebody's boss after they've done an amazing job. And, you know, it's a very small investment of your time, but it can actually matter a lot for the people that you're helping.
Have you done a five-minute favor today?
A five-minute favor today? Well,
yeah.
I think my most recent one was I was speaking at a conference, and then afterward I had a few people come up and ask me about give and take. And I feel like my responsibility there is to try to be helpful, so I offered to connect them with some of our students who might be able to support their nonprofit.
So we have a question from Twitter from a man named Diego, and he wanted to know, how do you balance competing work requests when time can't accommodate both? So you want to be a giver, but you just don't have time to do all the giving that you feel like you'd like to do.
Yeah, I think it's a great question. It's something that a lot of successful and unsuccessful givers struggle with. So first thing I would say is you want to ask, okay, where can I have the most unique impact? Can I make a distinctive contribution here? Or if not, then I'll connect this person to somebody else who's equally or better suited to help. And I think that's one really powerful way to decide which requests to handle. I think a second one is to think about, okay, every time that you help somebody else, you're potentially making an investment in encouraging them to be helpful as well. And so I would want to make that investment with people that you think can maybe bring the greatest return, not necessarily back to you, but who might pay it forward the most. And so, you know, if you've got two different requests and you think one person is likely to go and share that knowledge with others to help them, then that's the person I would often prioritize.
Now, if there's one piece of advice that you could give our listeners that they could walk away from this interview with, that maybe we all get wrong at work or a lot of us get wrong, what would it be?
Well, I think that a lot of people think that you have to be always on the giving end of every exchange if you want to be known as a helpful and generous person. And the received wisdom here is successful givers are actually quite comfortable asking for help. They know that we all need help sometimes, and they also know that if they don't ask, they're depriving other people in their lives of the opportunity to be givers. And they're really missing out on then letting other people know what they need and how they can be helpful. And so I think one recommendation is try to create a norm either for yourself or people in your workplace that it's okay to ask for help when you need it so that everybody can step up and support each other.
Adam Grant is professor at the Wharton School and author of the new book, Give and Take. Thanks, Adam.
Thank you.
So sometimes being kind and tactful and giving at work, it just doesn't cut it. And thankfully for those moments, the internet has given us some eCards.com. Now, you've probably seen these around. I actually didn't know that's what they were called. But they're these digital greeting cards with black and white drawings on solid color backgrounds with snarky to completely inappropriate messages. And they seem to express all the things you're thinking but would actually never, ever say out loud. Duncan Mitchell and Brooke Lundy are the co-founders of Some eCards and are with us now. Hi, guys.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
So when it comes to the workplace, what cards are out there? What are people complaining about? You laugh.
I mean, every aspect of their jobs. Duncan and I worked together in advertising for like 15 years. So it was a great lab for discovering every possible way to complain about work. And that's kind of how we started with some e-cards was, you know, our own brand of complaining and just kind of saying things that felt honest to us that maybe people were thinking but didn't have a way to express.
Give me some examples. What are we talking about?
Of our workplace cards?
Yeah, of your workplace cards. And, you know, this is a public radio show, so.
Yeah, I was about to say, yeah.
I think one of the earliest ones that's still popular today is when work feels overwhelming, remember that you're going to die. I think that that's kind of an optimistic message kind of wrapped in a bit of a cynical package because it's, you know, it's saying don't take things so seriously. You know, everybody's work gets overwhelming and you've got bigger problems to worry about eventually.
Others that you guys really like, workplace related?
One is let's boost office morale by going out to drink and complain about office morale. Sorry, your post-vacation workload has completely negated all the benefits of your vacation.
I mean, I think another thing is, you know, we try to do cards that are topical or relevant to things that are going on currently. So we just got off a 3-day weekend or a long weekend. And one of the most popular cards this week is I'm worried how I'm going to fit the 15 minutes of work I actually do into this 4-day work week.
So we on the show have heard lots of workplace complaints, and I wondered if you guys could do a few sort of off the top of your head cards for us with very specific problems. Do you mind?
Not at all.
All right. Here we go. Greeting card you'd make for your moody, sort of hot and cold boss.
I assume you're referring to Duncan.
I'm glad you finally admitted that I'm your boss.
I would say something like, I wish anything about my job changed as often as my boss's mood.
Fair enough. And what about for the colleague that's too loud?
Yeah, I mean, we definitely have experienced people who make a lot of loud personal calls. We actually have a card that probably fits that, which is, I feel like I practically know you because of your ear-splitting phone conversations.
Which is true, I think, of a lot of people. Now, you guys work with, you know, sometimes darker-edged, snarkiness about work every day. Does it get you down? How do you deal with it?
I think it's, you know, the idea is the card should be cathartic. You know, I don't think we're wallowing in misery. I think we're expressing some of people's darker thoughts in a fun way. And I think by sharing them, people end up kind of diffusing some of the edge they feel in the office environment.
Right. I mean, I think also what's changed is that we actually like our jobs now. So it's harder to write these.
Right. You're losing your edge.
Yeah, right. Possibly. Right. Or we just have a lot of contributors that we have to make sure are miserable in their jobs.
Duncan Mitchell and Brooke Lundy are co-founders of SomeECards.com. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
We asked Brooke and Duncan to send us their favorite e-card about personal finance, and it says, I can't even afford a staycation. But maybe you've got a good card idea for us. Send it our way, and we'll pick our favorite to win a prize. You can find out more on our website, marketplacemoney.org. That's this week's Marketplace Money. But the show goes on our website, on Facebook, and on Twitter. We're at Radio Piggy Bank. Join us online to talk about pretty much anything money-related. Marketplace Money is produced by Patty Hirsch with Devin Maverick Robbins, Lindsay Foster Thomas, and Daryl Perinata. Our engineer this week is Charlton Thorpe. The executive producer of the program is Deborah Clark. The Marketplace General Manager is J.J. Orr, and I'm Adrian Hill. Enjoy your weekend. This is 8 p.m.